Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT, and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Hello, 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 my wonderful audience. I'm as usual in my home office, looking out over the trees on the hill in the background and looking at the birds coming and going from my bird feeders that hang out the big piece of glass I have there and where the wall, most of the wall used to be. Glad to be with you again. I've got a really great guest today. Let me just check and see if he's there. Tom, you there?
Peter, I'm definitely here.
Oh, that's great. That's great. I've had Tom Moore on before. He's one of the most informed scientific people in the field of adverse drug reactions, and I'll tell you a little more about him after I finish with my intro. A lot of good things going on with me. Cheryl Atkinson, A-T-T-K-I-S-S-O-N. She has a syndicated TV show called Full Measure. It's on Sundays around the country, around where I am. It's the Syracuse station carries it. And she's done a wonderful interview of me about psych drugs. That's just really powerful. You may be able to get it. The show's called Full Measure, and it was a week ago from this past Sunday. And Aaron and Melissa Dykes, who did that great film, 2 million list downloads so far, The Minds of Men on Mind Control. She stopped by my house, two of them actually, Aaron and Melissa, for a visit, ended up filming me again for just a short discussion of my new organization, Stop the Psychiatric Abuse of Children, SPAC, with Michael Cornwall. And that was inspired by our outrage over hooking up children to electrodes, the FDA's approval on the basis of 35 children for 4 weeks. Not even a study, it was worthless, approving hooking these kids up for all night long brain stimulation with no limit for the rest of their lives, whatever some prescriber and some family wants to do. And it's supposed to be for ADHD, which is just a travesty, putting electrical currents through the brains of these children. And we've got on Breggin.com. Just go down a little bit and you'll see that children's page and you'll see the SPAC and you'll see a film that Aaron and Melissa, a short film that they made out of my interview. It's more than just an interview. And I am just so full of feeling and yet reason and outrage and so many different things as I talk in this film about what it's going to be like when we have millions of children hooking themselves, being hooked up in the evenings, and then there'll be alternatives, I'm sure, and then they'll modify it, and then they'll energize it some more, because this is from the division of the FDA that has to do with devices, and they're unscrupulous. They allowed ECT to go on for years untested without saying anything about it, just allowed it to go on, went back and forth about it. And when we finally forced, on the basis of a report I wrote for a judge, an affidavit, forced the drug company Thymatron to admit it caused brain damage and caused memory loss, within 2 or 3 days, the FDA went ahead and for the first time approved ECT. So we're talking, and this is that devices group. And they've also allowed electroshock to be energized 20 times over the way it was originally used years ago, and they never have interfered with the shock docs and the shock machine people doing this. So we're in a very desperate situation. Go look up on my website the children's section and SPAC, Stop the Psychiatric Abuse of Children. You're listening, of course, to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour, and it's August 7th at 4 o'clock, New York time, a few minutes after 4. You can call in and ask me questions and Tom questions about these issues. But again, if you have general questions, wait till the last Wednesday of the month, please, and call in as you have been doing. But I'd sure like to see people call in specifically about the content of the show. You all seem more settled into just listening when I have a guest on and enjoying it, not calling in, and then waiting till you can call in about all the stuff that interests you the last Wednesday of the month. And remember, we have the archives. You call in on 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. Tom, hi, welcome to the show. It's really always great to have you on. Produces a bulletin called Quarter Watch, which has amazing material in it. He is really a scientist. He's senior scientist at what's the name of your organization again, Tom?
The Institute for Safe Medication Practices.
Forgive me for that. ISMP. And he teaches at George Washington University, and he's also done legal work in the area of, for example, Risperdal and its effects on kids. He's a good man. So welcome to the show, and tell us about some of your latest research or talk about any of the things on your mind right now.
Okay, well, I do have a couple of topics for you to consider. I published last year in a medical journal, the Journal of the American Medical Association, Internal Medicine, a study of the most widely used sleep medication, which is Zolpidem or Ambien.
And tell us about it. I'm looking at it right now at the study. It's very important. And the stuff that's going on with Ambien and the FDA is overall very important. So what'd your study find?
Well, there are two parts. Let's sort of start at the top. And it's a way, it's a story of a lot of psychiatric and psychoactive drugs. And that is, it's addressing a real problem, which is something like one out of three adults has a problem with insomnia, and something like 10% have enough of a problem with insomnia that it impairs their activities the next day. So let's start. We got a big problem. The most widely used sleep medication is Zolpidem, or it's also known as Ambien. It might be great if we had an answer to a problem that so many people have, but it's not. And so the headline finding of the study that I published last year was that 77% of the people who were taking this drug, and there were about 3.5 million of them, were not following one or more safety recommendations. So here is the drug. That's sort of point one. Point two is the sad fact is we don't have good drug answers to problems of insomnia. And so when you actually test Zolpidem, it turns out that for a short term, if you just take it and I'm sure you got a lot of listeners out there who have taken it or are taking it. For the first couple of nights, it actually has a modestly good effect. Probably sleeping, 40 minutes more than usual. But after 14 days of continuous use, the effect is lost, and you actually can't distinguish it from a placebo. But people keep taking it, partly because it has some addictive properties, rebound effects. Partly it's just sort of psychological dependence. And there's also a placebo effect, which is when we actually studied how well Ambien worked, it turned out the people taking the placebo after 2 weeks were reporting they were sleeping about 20 minutes more. But the problem is that what we have is we have drugs that don't work.
So you're
very
saying placebo was better at 2 weeks than the Ambien?
No, it was indistinguishable from Ambien.
Okay.
Only a couple of minutes different. So, but the second problem, and this is the issue that really comes up with all drugs we take, is we have drugs have benefits and we have risks. And so if we really find that after 2 weeks it's really not helping, all we have is risk. So that's partly what the paper is about. So what are the risks that we're exposing people to when they keep taking it? Well, the first thing is they aren't taking it short term. More than 70% of the people are taking it every day long term. So that's problem number one. Problem number two is they're combining it with drugs that have, that's because it doesn't work very well, okay? So 44% of the people who were taking this drug were taking two or more medications that worked in the same neurotransmitter system. So that might make you sleep a little better, but we're also talking about risks of next day impairment. So it's sort of a sad story because we really need drugs, or we really, most of us, many of us need to sleep better than we do. This is the answer that millions of people turn to, and it doesn't work. And sort of as a society, we're not using it properly. In other words, saying it can work in the short term, but everybody's taking it long term. You don't want to combine it with an opioid or another drug that's active and depresses your central nervous system, but that's what happens. So it's like a lot of psychiatric drugs, which is we aren't using them wisely, and sadly, they have some effects, but they aren't very large.
What about the terrible effects of this drug? It causes sleepwalking, sleep cooking, sleep driving, sleep climbing out of windows. It can cause other bizarre behaviors. Have you researched that at all or reviewed what's going on at the FDA? Because they look like they are raising a lot of issues about this recently.
Well, this also has to do with the dose and people taking too much of it. Again, because the drug doesn't work very well, people want to take more of it. But it has a series of adverse effects in some patients. And they can be a variety of bizarre forms of behavior. Now, one of the problems, I do drug safety research full time. One of the problems we have is we know we have these cases. We can go out, I find them in my adverse event data, you know, every quarter and every year. But we really don't know how many people are affected. But some of these behaviors, and it also can include suicidal behaviors, can be very serious. I think actually, Peter, you left out sleep sex as well.
That actually passed me by. That's interesting. Well, any sleep activity. But do you get sleep rape where somebody turns on somebody else and takes advantage of them under the influence?
I was wondering about that. Now, or it might go the other way around. So somebody had sleep and then woke up the next morning and didn't realize they'd done it.
Oh, okay. So the more like a roofie effect would be what you might expect, too. You could have either, I think, from a drug like this. I would expect that you could become a passive participant or even an unconscious participant because you're drugged, or you could, just like sleep cooking or sleep driving, you could take advantage of a person without hardly knowing what you're doing.
Well, I have a little story about a real case. It's a different sleep medication, one of the benzodiazepines, that kind of gives you a feeling of, in the worst cases, when it triggers abnormal behavior. Now, I want to say that we don't know how often it happens, but I still would have to caution everybody, it's relatively rare. It is to say, most people, this doesn't happen to. But any case, and this actually was a case that was a psychiatrist told me about. So there was a young man who was sleeping with his girlfriend and couldn't get to sleep, so he took one of her benzodiazepines. Well, he only went to sleep, you'll recognize some of the key symptoms here. He only went to sleep for about 20 minutes, and then he got up, and he went to the closet where he got out his baseball bat. Now, fortunately, it wasn't the girlfriend. He went out into the driveway and started smashing the windows of his own car. Well, it was such a fracas that the police were called, and when they arrived and tried to restrain him, he was in such a frenzy that he actually broke one of the policeman's jaw. So Wow. That gives you, when psychiatric drugs, and we don't know how many, we know that they occur. I think both you and I have been experts in cases that involve violence. But they are very tragic, and many people just don't want to believe that in some people this can happen. But the answer is, I'm sort of here to tell you, it can. There may be other drugs more likely than Ambien, Zolpidem, but we see cases there too.
Yeah, and I think the sleepwalking, these kind of automatic activities are not as rare as you're describing, simply because I meet so many people who say, oh, yeah, that happened to me, or it happened to my mother, just in chatting about these drugs. I have a feeling that a lot of people have these strange reactions, but maybe, you know, they fortunately don't get into a lot of trouble. What is the FDA doing? I mean, I read that they were going to look into all of these newer drugs that are sort of like benzos, but not quite, like Ambien. And Lunesta, I think, is another one that causes these very similar things. Is the FDA doing much about it? Have you been able to keep up with that? I have not been able to keep up with it.
Well, there are two. The FDA's done two things over recent years. And there's one piece of perhaps good news that I can't quite explain. But the first thing that they did several years ago was that they reduced the recommended dose for both women and the elderly. There were studies that showed that in those two patient populations, the blood levels were about 40% higher. So they recommended halving the dose for those and tried to push that. The other thing that I think you were referring to is they did put out a warning. About sleepwalking and other abnormal behaviors associated with it. Now, something else is going on, and I'm not sure how it's exactly linked to the FDA, but partly. But I track the use of these drugs year by year. And actually, over the last 3 or 4 years, the usage of it has dropped quite a lot, from over 5 million people being regularly users to about 3.5 million. Now, what I hear anecdotally is that providers and health plans are no longer routinely renewing these drugs. And so that may be why we're seeing the utilization decline, which is good news, because this is a drug that can work for people on a short-term basis. But over a long-term basis, you have risk. Over a long-term basis, you have only the impression that it's helping you sleep. And then the other problem is all the things out there that you can combine it with. Alcohol that can cause next-day impairment or worse. If you need a pain medication, an opioid, it's combined. So that's the other problem. Or some people add a benzodiazepine because it doesn't work. Then we're talking about people whose health is who's taking on too much of a drug that suppresses the central nervous system.
Yeah. Keep in mind, folks, that within that short-term period of using it and perhaps getting some sleep help, quite often the worst adverse effects also occur in the first couple of weeks before the brain can get used to the drug, which is the tolerance. So you also have a lot of the adverse effects will pile up in the beginning. And there's just many other kinds of things on Ambien and also on Sonata and Lunesta, which are these very similar drugs, and including like confusion and anxiety, just muscle cramps. People get a lot of different negative effects, often sedative-like effects from these drugs. Not the best thing in the world. Go ahead.
I was about to say it's a problem that we have across psychiatric drugs, which is we have people with real problems. We have people who do have reverses in life or for other reasons become depressed. We do have a lot of people who have trouble sleeping. The answers we have in terms of a pill are not very effective. And so when people find that out, they start combining drugs, combining it with alcohol.
Right.
They're still reaching for an answer. And so you took what might be a modest risk, and then you've doubled or tripled it.
Yeah. I think it's very, very important. And memory loss, also depression. You mentioned people being depressed. Depression is another one of the things that people see with this group of drugs. And any sedative can affect your memory. And while you might not get, hopefully won't get permanent memory loss from using it for a week or two, you might not perform as well the next morning on a test. That's very important because these drugs do affect the laying down of memories. So that's another problem for the college students and whoever else are, borrowing a sleeping pill, Xanax or any sedative drug. You're going to have less good memory the following morning. A lot of stuff. My view that I talk about, Tom, more and more is, look, these are all neurotoxins. So they're poisoning your brain. So expect all kinds of negative things can happen. They're variable. They're unpredictable. And see if you can find better solutions. And insomnia is a very difficult problem. It's a difficult problem in therapy at times to help people with. Some of the things that do help are routines, having a routine that you enjoy before bed. Begin the routine an hour before bedtime so you have time to relax. I like to spend at least an hour and sometimes hopefully two with ginger before bedtime. So us with those brains that never stop moving, we can just keep each other company, maybe give each other back rubs, do whatever you know, feels nice for us to relax in the evening. And having the rituals to look forward to is very important. So, and enlist your partner, if you have one, to make the evening something to anticipate. Maybe a light snack. Alcohol has the very same problems as Ambien. It may help you for a night or two get some sleep, but very quickly the brain starts to fire back. And
I'd add two more suggestions to your list.
Good.
I think exercise during the day promotes more relaxed evening and sleep. So I think that can help. The other thing I was going to add to alcohol is alcohol has a better than half life of about 5 hours.
Right.
And so if you have a couple drinks because you're anxious or upset, and you have a couple of extra drinks, you're going to hit 2 o'clock in the morning, and you're going to belt wide awake because the alcohol has been eliminated from your system, or most of it.
Yeah.
So that's the second reason alcohol doesn't really help you there.
The Ambien's half-life, 1.5 hours. That's the half-life. Now, the effects are going to last somewhat longer. There's a suggestion here I'm reading that it can last up to 8 hours, some of the effects. But you're going to have even more rebound then from alcohol because it's got quite a bit of shorter effect. And it's unconscionable, I think, to produce drugs with these short half-lives and call them sleeping pills, because it's just inevitable that the brain's going to catch right back up and start forcing, more energy, more alertness, and with that more anxiety and more agitation.
Well,
any more thoughts
story.
About go ahead.
I do. Yeah, I have one more little story to tell you about, which is as usual, of course, you have the shorter half-life of Zolpidem Ambien, correct? So I don't know, about 8 years ago, a sustained release version was created. That substantially, and you know, it was the pill was created in a different way, so it was released. And the other thing that had happened since Zolpidem Ambien was approved, the FDA had gotten somewhat more demanding about testing it, about testing the drug. So they actually, for the sustained release, where they were hoping to see a better, longer effect, they actually tested people in a sleep lab. So we didn't, you know, often people actually sleep better than they think they do. So they were actually measuring it with sonograms. And so what happened when they used these more sophisticated techniques to measure how much sleep? Well, once again, at 14 to 15 days, the effects could not be distinguished from a placebo.
Yeah.
So the answer to that is sleep is an incredibly complex process. This is one of the reasons why we have so many problems with psychiatric drugs. And that is that, you know, this is a, you know, there are like seven different stages. There are all kinds of other interacting neurotransmitters. And so just hammer one, GABA, and it's probably, you know, you're probably not going to get, one, the effect that you want, and you're going to probably get a lot of effects that you don't want. And that really is a story that extends to other drugs, too.
Absolutely. It's pretty random, the way these drugs affect the brain. Everybody's brain is different. Everybody responds differently to drugs. The brain is complex beyond our imagination, complex beyond any theoretical understanding. Put a neurotoxin into it, and you're taking risks. And the longer you you take it, the more that your brain will simply begin to subdue the drug effect. either to jack you up and charge you up if it's a sedative, or to sedate you if you're being jacked up by the drug. It's a pretty simple formula, but it generally works, that the brain doesn't want the intrusion, produces a grossly opposite effect, and then in the long run, I think all psychoactive drugs, marijuana, doesn't matter what it is, they're going to have somewhat of a dulling effect on your quality of life. The brain just doesn't stay as sharp long term on medications. Go ahead, Tom.
Well, I was the phrase that I used for another class of drugs, but with a similar sort of problem, is that you basically have a chemical bull in a china shop.
Yeah.
And the body is adjusting to it, and I'd be a little more technical than you, not disagreeing, but all kinds of things, once you put the chemical bull is loose, your body makes all kinds of different sorts of adjustments. So actual neuroreceptors, in some cases, and you were talking about it making people anxious, in some cases, because the natural circuit is being blocked by the drug, the cells actually produce more receptors. The opposite can happen, which is what you're sort of talking about with dulling, which is to say, because the receptors are blocked, they're not working properly, they get absorbed. Now, the problem and the reason we get withdrawal and rebound and other kind of symptoms is that in some cases, if you stop the drug, the brain cells restore those receptors to their normal balance that they had. But in some cases, they don't. Or in some cases, it takes, and of course, you have a whole book about psychiatric withdrawal, and that's about people whose receptors have not been restored.
Yeah, and these changes that drugs make in the brain where the receptors downregulate, that is, they reduce their numbers and their sensitivity. There's two different effects. They reduce numbers and sensitivity, or they upregulate in response and increase their sensitivity and numbers, can become permanent. And tardive dyskinesia, this terrible abnormal movement disorder that you get from any dopamine blocker, which is all of the routinely used antipsychotic drugs and some other drugs as well, and you end up with permanent upregulation causing hyperactive movements from all the blocking. And the animal studies have shown that with the antidepressants, that the response of the serotonergic system, of course, is to resist the jacking up of serotonin in the synapses, and you get this loss of receptors, and in animals it's been found to last for months after cessation of the drug exposure. So it's all very serious stuff we're doing. Let me take a question on insomnia from Julie in Massachusetts. Are you there, Julie?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, very clearly.
Yes. I have had a struggle with I've called in before, and I've had a struggle with insomnia for 8 years now, and recently I discovered the reason it took all this long. The reason is because I have kidney disease from the drug lithium. And when you have kidney disease as advanced as mine is, you can't make melatonin anymore. And it's been going on for quite some time. I didn't get any answers from the medical community. So I have remedied it with street drugs. And unfortunately, what I want to do, you know, what I'm trying to do is cut down. What can you do when your body can't make melatonin? And it's not an issue of thinking too much. It's not an issue of anxiety. It's just that your body will not sleep.
Well, I mean, the first thing one would think of would be to take melatonin. It's readily available over the counter.
Do you recommend a particular kind? Because nothing seems to work. I've tried different kinds, tried varying the dose. It never works.
The melatonin doesn't work.
No, unfortunately. But is there are there different kinds, like different sources? Because
I don't know about that. How many times? Do you know anything about varieties of melatonin?
Well, the problem we have is with any other neurotransmitter, which is, it's not clear that you get the melatonin. I'm afraid it's not the supplement.
I don't think you can even use it. That's what I'm thinking.
That's closer to which is to say, does the melatonin is part of a signaling system, and it gets a little of it gets emitted by a cell across a little, for a millisecond. So simply flooding your, I'm not even sure how much of it gets across the blood-brain barrier. So I'm afraid that a melatonin, probably everybody is different. And also, it's almost like any of this, a short-term effect, you might see a short-term effect. So no, I wish I had an answer for you on the melatonin products, but I would have to say I'm not surprised that you didn't see many effects. I think you would have to see a sleep specialist and to look at, your chemistry and other things. It's way beyond anything that I could make a recommendation to you specifically.
The problem is they want to test me for sleep apnea. I know it's not sleep apnea. It's been 8 years now. I would know by now, and other people have been in the room when I have slept, unfortunately. But no one's ever noticed me stopping breathing, and I don't have any of the symptoms. I don't wake up gasping, and they insist on testing me for sleep apnea first. And so I have stopped it right there. I said, I don't want to be tested. This is a waste. Can you just give me some answers? And they don't. They want to test. They insist on, it must be sleep apnea, but it's not.
What would happen if what you're concerned about with getting tested and they rule out sleep apnea to their satisfaction, then maybe they can...
Then they send you to a psychiatrist, right?
Well, you know enough to not do that, but I think you may, maybe you shouldn't deprive yourself of going through some sleep testing. Just a thought. And I did very quickly pulled up an article with just what you're saying, association between chronic kidney disease and sleep disturbances. Just to let the audience know that does exist. It's a very tough subject, the insomnia issues. And I do think that the best things available have to do with soothing routines in the evening, and maybe trying alternative approaches like meditation before sleep, maybe even trying some acupuncture and seeing if it'll help you. Trying alternative treatments and especially things like, imaging at night. You've done all that?
I exercise during the day. I run quite a bit. That's my meditation. But I did try acupuncture for a while. It's just not available to me in my area. Not at least they won't. I would have to travel pretty far, and I'm concerned about the expense. How often I would have to have it, et cetera. I could do it once a week. I don't think I could afford it any more often than that.
Well, I wish you very good luck. I'm glad you called in. Tom, any other thoughts?
No, I hate to be the sad sack here, but one of the problems we have is we don't have a very powerful array of drugs that work effectively with sleep. The ones we have really serious drawbacks. So I think that I would agree with Peter about that to see what you can do with non-pharmacological approaches, but also I would agree with Peter that a sleep apnea test, it's not an invasive or damaging test. Just so your physician has ruled that out, would be something worth considering.
And they'll find other things, and on a sleep test, they're not just going to be looking at sleep apnea.
Yeah.
Well, good luck.
Okay.
Good luck, Julie. And if you do take the sleep test, give us a call back.
Oh, I'll certainly let you know. Thank you.
Thank you, dear. Tom, we are moving along. We've got about 20 minutes left. Do you want to talk about some of the other research or anything interesting, exciting you're doing? Because you do a lot of stuff.
Well, yes, I have another drug that we're using extremely unwisely and extremely widely. And that is a drug called gabapentin. It's also called Neurontin. And there's one that's very similar that's a brand name drug called Lyrica. And so here is another. So we're actually on the same neuroreceptors. We're going to just call them GABA receptors. And this actually is a synthetic form of GABA, the neurotransmitter. So let's just start. And so what does it do when you take, in the synthetic form, gets it past the blood-brain barrier? So you get the neurotransmitter. So you get the neurotransmitter into circulation. So what does it do? Well, the answer to that is it's really not clear. It was approved by the FDA, if we're using gabapentin or whatever, 15 or 20 years ago for two very narrow forms of epilepsy. And then I think Lyrica has indication for fibromyalgia. So you would say, well, gee, we don't really understand what it's doing. The testing of it was very limited. So you wouldn't think there was very much of it being used. Well, the opposite of it is true. The opposite of it is true. There is only one psychoactive drug, and that is hydrocodone, opioid, and acetaminophen, that is more widely used than gabapentin. So here's, and that is taken by 8.5 million, and then add another almost 2 million for Lyrica. And so we have 10 million out of 240 million adults, roughly, who are taking this drug. Well, why are they taking it? Well, and it's basically irresponsible physician use. They're just tossing it into cocktails of other drugs that also don't work very well. So when I looked at the 10 million people taking one of these GABA drugs, the answer was we're talking about patients who were taking all kinds of dangerous, untested drug cocktails. So just some of these numbers are just stunning. Half the people taking gabapentin were taking overall 10 or more drugs.
Oh, Lord. That's just amazing.
10 or more drugs, including three psychoactive drugs. A quarter of them were taking five or more psychiatric drugs. So now we're looking at sort of what we might call the reverse Peter Bregan effect, which is there are groups of physicians and patients who will go along with this, who when they start to realize that the drug is not working very well for the patient or might have side effects, what do? They add another drug. So we have a whole population out there. We have a whole population out there with these drug cocktails that we've never tested. Now, Lyrica has significant withdrawal effects, might be a little less for gabapentin. But it apparently leads to other problems. So 37% of the people taking this drug regularly were also taking opioids. So we're talking about serious central nervous system depression. The other thing that happened with gabapentin is it's cheap. $30, you can buy about $30, you can buy a month's supply. It's a generic. And so in Kentucky, when they did a study of drug overdose deaths, almost one out of, and they did, you know, they did blood, see what they died of. It was mostly opioids, but one out of three also had gabapentin. So people are taking this drug thinking that they're developing tolerance to opioids and think that they will add people who are sadly addicted. are thinking that it will hype up the drug effect, and apparently sometimes with fatal results. So here we have, again, this sort of a second case of a drug. The other real use of gabapentin is probably your listeners know that you and I share skepticism about how well antidepressant drugs work. A simple line that I use is, in the clinical studies of antidepressants, half of them fail to show any benefit at all. So what happens when, once again, you get a disappointing result? Well, docs just simply throw gabapentin in. Same thing happens. We don't have great drugs for pain. They're trying to stay out of opioids. So they throw gabapentin in, even though there's really no evidence that it probably helps much. And so the other shocking number that I came up with was when I looked at the people taking gabapentin. And once again, remember, this is the second most widely used psychoactive drug in the country. I found about 47% of them were taking an antidepressant. And why is that? Once again, it's the sort of daisy chain of psychiatric drugs that don't work too well. So they're trying to find a way. So they're tossing this in. Maybe it'll help.
They're very mind-bending drugs. Lyrica, which they really push to replace the narcotics, is what it just fogs your brain. I think it's a bad thing we're seeing, where there's so much emphasis on the dangers of opiates, which in many ways are not as dangerous as the psychiatric drugs, and we're seeing them being replaced by the psychiatric drugs, which we have far more studies showing cognitive difficulties and permanent problems with. And it makes me just huff and puff. Let me go to Sarah, who's in California. Sarah's a dear friend of mine, Tom. Started out as somebody in the audience, and she's really a very reform-minded, active person. Say hello to Tom, Sarah.
Hey, Tom.
Say hello to Sarah.
Hi, Peter.
So what's up, Sarah?
Well, I'm just listening to both of your discussions on these sleep medications and psychoactive substances, and it just really reiterates that psychiatry is exceptional at jerry-rigging the central nervous system to force function, but you can only jerry-rig it for so long, and forcing function is like wearing a cast on a leg that's broken, and then leaving the cast on for too long. And essentially the central nervous system is just atrophying as these receptors are upregulated and downregulated, and it's like a third world country electrical system, and they just keep throwing other things at it, trying to force more function.
That's a good analogy. It's a little scary, but it's they're turning our brains into third world countries. I like that.
Well, I agree with you, but in some ways I'd be even a little more pessimistic. And that is to say, I think that several things happen. One, the jury rigging is not like we have a scientific, let's try one, and if the one doesn't work, we have a stepped therapy to two. Basically, they're just tossing other drugs in. The second one is the cascade problem. The second problem, the way you get to those people I'm talking about who are taking five or, you know, half of the GABA population taking five or more psychoactive drugs, and I have a colleague who's actually studying this, has a grant from the National Institute on Aging. The second problem you have is the cascade. And the cascade is this: antidepressant drugs for maybe one third of those who take it, maybe a little less, it makes them anxious and gives them insomnia. So guess what? Out comes the Zolpidem. So we get a cascade of chasing the adverse effects. You may get the other way around. So maybe 25% of the people who take antidepressant drugs actually become somnolent. This is the bull in the china shop. Actually become somnolent and sort of dopey. So guess what? Out comes the amphetamine-like stimulants. And so the cascade is the other way we get the people on the, what you were talking about.
Yeah. It's desperate for so many people who, you know, they hear Dr. Bregan on the show, they read about the, you know, be very careful about these medications. We really need to, you know, get off of these medications, be very careful getting off of these medications. And sometimes people work on getting off of the medications, but they get off of them too quickly. And then they're just slammed with the paradoxical effect. It's just this whiplash that comes out of nowhere. And then it just impacts their entire life and their entire ability to function. I have so many friends who are just literally laying in bed daily trying to figure out, you know, how do I repair my central nervous system after getting off of these medications?
Well, you do raise another good point that all your listeners should pay attention to. After hearing someone like me being as pessimistic as I am about the limits of psychiatric medications, and that is, you also can't just stop. And Peter Bregan has a wonderful book about it. There's some other resources on this. It turns out that most physicians, are not well educated. I wrote a study about some of this material a few years ago, are not well educated. They don't understand how long it can take to separate people from some of these drugs. So if you're hearing this and saying, I don't want them, you need to, you know, separating yourself from these drugs, even including just you're taking Zolpidem, you're probably going to have a rebound effect. After hearing this, don't just willy-nilly say, no more of that tomorrow. I mean, I guess people have done that. But you kind of need a plan. You kind of need an overview. You may need to consult with a sympathetic physician.
So true.
Tom, I had a really interesting discovery recently. For a legal case, I got a 5-year report from the FDA, you know, the summary reports that has all of the adverse effects reported over 5 years. And I did it for Zoloft, sertraline, up through 2012, 5 years up to 2012. And I searched homicides. Tom, I got 20 unique reports of homicide over 5 years for Zoloft. That sounds incredible to me. Are you aware of more and more reports? Because certainly your study, which is the best study done on reports of violence to the FDA, you didn't have anything like that just a few years earlier.
Well, I think I disagree. I think my study disclosed quite a few acts of violence that included homicides.
I'm talking about 15 for Zoloft for 5 years. That's 20. I'm sorry, 20.
Well,
I should have asked you about that. I'll have to have you back on to talk about this issue.
Okay. So, as you know, I did do, and there could have been more recently, I did do a study of violence associated with reports of violence, and homicide was one of the endpoints. I don't at the moment recall the number. I'm not surprised, but let me give you a word of caution, because I guess both of us have been experts in cases that might involve criminal activity. Crimes are very complicated and have a lot of circumstances. And evaluating those reports might lead us to believe that some of those reports were the drug was less likely to be involved.
Oh, I'm sure. I have no doubt about that. The number was stunning, though. I've not seen anything like that. In your report, Zoloft didn't make the break point the P was, I think, 0.02 or something. But I'm going to talk to you about that separately. We're getting toward Maybe I'll send you a little email about it with some of the data. Thanks for being on the show. You're such a scientist, and you're so thoughtful about everything you do in this arena. And I'm glad to see you getting involved in some legal cases. Any wind-up thoughts about what we're talking about today?
Well, my summary is I guess 3 points. The drugs that we've been talking about address big problems, sleep, or very serious problems, psychosis and schizophrenia, or very widespread problems of variety of types, depression. These are big problems. These are real problems for people. These are impairing the quality of life, and I myself take them very seriously. The sad fact is, because of what I call the bull in the china shop effect here, most of our drugs have very modest effects. Many physicians grossly overrate their benefits and underrate and aren't sensitive enough to their side effects. And I guess I would not say don't ever use any of these, but I would say be very careful, be very skeptical, understand that your expectations have to be low, and don't take them for any longer than absolutely necessary.
It's a good summary. In my practice, as most of you know, I think I have a lot of regular listeners. I actually conduct my practice and have always, since I finished my training in 1966, I have always avoided starting people on psychiatric drugs. And I've treated people coming out of hospital, psychotic, on drugs, and, you know, wean them off and work with their families. So many of the issues we deal with are best improved by working with families, especially with the children. When you have children, I think it's a crime to give kids psychoactive drugs. I don't think they should get, amphetamines, any more than they should get them illegally. So think about how you can work with your family or a couple. Look for a good therapist. There are a lot of good therapists out there. That's our music. Tom Moore, thank you again for being on the show. You bring so much good sense and scientific knowledge. Thanks for calling in. And have a good rest of the week till I talk to you all again. Bye-bye now. Have a great week.
Bye-bye, Peter.
You too, Tom. Okay, bye-bye.